Welcome to the Winged Hazaar Pubcast. From fantasy to sci-fi to history and horror, your hosts are about to take you on a journey through all things Winged Hazaar Publishing. Sit back and relax as we talk about writing, gaming, as well as interview some of your favorite authors. Let's wing it.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Winged Hustler Pubcast. In today's episode, we're going to reverse what we did in our first author interview, and instead, our good friend Ben Stoddard will be joining me in interviewing Mark about his writing career in Kings of War novels. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Brandon, here with my usual host, Mark.
Hello!
And today, we have Ben Stoddard joining us again.
Hello!
This is going to be another two-part episode like our last author interview. The first episode will be chatting with Mark in a general overview of his writings within and without Winged Hustler Publishing, and the second episode will be doing a bit more of a deep dive of Mark's characters and stories. We'll be talking about Steps to Deliverance at the end of this episode, and the next one will focus on Hero Falling, Faith Aligned, and Pious. Mark, by now our listeners know that you host this podcast alongside me, and that you've written a fair amount of novels in different genres and IPs. Do you want to elaborate on that and reiterate to remind everyone what you've written, not only with us, but with other companies?
I started writing with Osprey Publishing, which is military history. So I was writing about military aviation in World War II and then a little bit in World War I. After that, I jumped across and I was a historical consultant for War Thunder, which is, now a PS5 game and PC. Then I went back to Osprey, who had just joined forces with Warlord Games. So I wrote five campaign books for Bolt Action. And that led on to meeting you guys and jumping across to Winged Hussar. And I've written for Gates of Antares, Kings of War, and Infinity.
Yeah, and I mean, you've done a fair number of novels with us, starting, like you said, with Antares, and then going to Kings of War and Infinity. You've kind of covered all the different genres, except for, you know, writing a history book with us. But, you know, that's another topic we can discuss at some point. And, you know, despite hosting this show with me, I mean, you kind of have a little bit of a larger role with us than some of the other authors. I mean, you know, you've worked closely with managing the fiction with especially Kings of War, and a lot of people see you as like a go-to, especially on the Basileian stuff. How do you feel about working with us in comparison with some of the other companies you've worked with?
It's awesome. It's every company I've worked with has been really different, and it's had a really different vibe. And I guess the nicest thing to do would be to kind of say, with each of the companies I've worked with, here's something which really stands out of kind of what's really cool about them. Osprey, back in the day, really slick, really professional. Everything ran on rails, which was really nice because it's such a huge company. Or at least it certainly felt that way. Having kind of worked, once you get into the wargaming side of things, I think with the exception of the one big guy on the block, companies tend to be a bit smaller. Whereas Osprey, huge company. So they were great to give me my intro into that. Then jumped across to Warlord Games. If I was to pick one thing about Warlord Games, like, some people really value experiences in life. Some people like stuff. And I'm one of those people, like a lot of wargamers, hoarders, collectors who like stuff. And Warlord are a very, very generous company with their incentives and the box sets which come through the post. That made me feel valued. I liked that. Well done, Warlord. Corvus Belli, what would I say? I think they're the best all-rounder. There's a little bit of everything with Corvus Belli. Really nice company to work for. Mantic, I think the standalone, the best thing about Mantic is just how fast you get replies to when you've got a lore query. So like I've worked with some companies where you can send in a lore query, and worst case, just any query, worst case, I've waited half a year for a response, and when your deadline is 12 months, that's kind of crippling, really.
Right.
Whereas with Mantic, I have literally had responses on Sundays within 10 minutes. It's crazy, you know. So Matt Gilbert, it's like a round the clock consultancy service he gives for Panathor. It's great. And then that brings us to Winged Hussar, which for me is the most personal service. I think it sounds so trite, but it's doing a project with your mates rather than working for a company. And I'm much, much, much happier in that environment, which is why Winter Sars, the company I've done most books with. It's because I enjoy it. It's the vibe. It's the camaraderie. It's the Final Fantasy VII banter. It's all that stuff, which you do. When we just get massively sidetracked and end up not achieving actual output and work and instead talking about computer games, that's why I'm here. So yeah, I've enjoyed all of that stuff, definitely. But I think every company, they're all good to work with in a different way. They just run their show in a different way. And as long as you turn up and kind of come to grips quite quickly with here's how this bunch of individuals wants to run their show and you get on board with it, it all works really nicely.
Well, I appreciate the kind words and the conversations we've had over the years.
Yeah, have you found a similar thing, Ben?
Yeah, I honestly, working for Mantic, I'll agree with you. It's really nice to be able to get lore questions answered really quickly. I know that someone is going to read the email at some point, and I'm not going to be left hanging for a long period of time without any response, so that's really useful. I've also like how I would add to that how liberal they are with allowing like novel projects and things along those lines. I don't think I've ever had an idea that has been straight up shot down that I've suggested. So I would throw that in as well. But Wing Tassar, though, I mean, Brandon and Vince, both, they've been awesome to work with. I can't think of a single complaint that I would throw out there about working with Wing Tassar. So legitimately, I think you hit the nail on the head that it's like hanging out with a group of buddies and not having to worry about, does it have to be professional 100% of the time, or can I actually say what I'm thinking, or can I bring up concerns or anything along those lines? And on top of that, I know that Brandon and Vince have my back regardless of what happens. So if there's ever any kind of kerfluffle or whatever the case may be, they're there to step in, and they're going to back their authors every time.
Well, thank you both for the kind words. You know, the core of what we are is, you know, we're people working with people. And I guess I've taken that experience from what I learned from Vince over the years, because, you know, before we started Wing Tassar, I've mentioned before, Vince was, you know, head of sales for Black Library. And so I've been to games days countless times over the years. And my childhood was going out to dinner with Dan Abnett, Mike Lee, Clint Werner, Graham McNeil. And, you know, when we were in Baltimore, we would just go out to dinner every night. I still remember fondly one, I think it was the last games that we went to, we sat in the pub, more or less, downstairs of the hotel we were staying at, and Dan regaled us with stories until, like, midnight. And between me, my sister, my friend who went with us, my dad, and my mom, we were in tears laughing until midnight. And that's part of what I want to bring to the table, is that camaraderie and that friendship of, you know, we're people. And we want to write good stories. You know, none of us, I think it's fair to say that none of the authors come to the table expecting, I'm going to write this novel and it's going to sell a million copies. And if it doesn't, I'm going to be pissed. I think everybody comes to the table of, I'm passionate about what I do and I want to see my writing come to fruition. It's kind of different when you're working with the IP versus the original setting because, you know, we've talked about this, I think, in our first IP episode, where, you know, if the setting goes to the graveyard, your work kind of goes to the graveyard too. But it's all about something you can put on your resume to help build your passion and your writing experience. That way, you know, you can say, I did this, and it went to print, and people read it, and it helped me build on skills. And that's kind of what I also want to help other authors do, is learn how to expand their writing craft, just like, you know, you both have helped me over the years with the various things. You know, I came to the table with what minimal experience I had, and I built on those foundations working with Wing Tassar Publishing. And with each author, I learned something different. I'll say, with the last book I just finished, John Leiby's Earhart, one of the things I did, and I took away from that experience, which I've never really thought about before, was character voice and narration. I think that's one of those things I kind of took for granted, but there were sentence structures that I didn't really know why he was doing short and didn't necessarily make sense, and explained to me, well, the character isn't really the smartest person, and he's kind of quick thinking, so not everything he says is going to make sense per se. And I'm like, that's an interesting thought. I just always, I think I got used to in my head saying the narration, I can chalk up to author style, but should flow a certain way to set a standard. But when I walked away from that project, I said, you know, that actually is a really strong point, is you don't want narration for every point of view character to be different. Or you don't want it to all be the same, because every character is going to be different. And if you're in point of view, you want that to stand out as, you know, this is the way this character is thinking. So it's been a great experience working with all you guys and taking a little bit away from every project and knowing how I can utilize it to help other authors out.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed reading through John's stuff as well. It's really weird, you know, kind of it's been over a year and we swap messages. We worked on other projects. We're working on a project together at the moment in the Kings of War setting. And I've never even spoke to him on a Skype meeting or anything. It's really odd that we do, I think, in Winged Hussar have this close-knit, small, international team of friends where you can bounce ideas off. But you never meet face-to-face, which is a bit of a shame. But for me, stuck over here on the other side of the pond, yeah, who knows? Maybe one day.
Well, I was trying to get... Adepticon is like one of the biggest conventions that we have over here that we go to. And every year it's always like, oh, smattering of people are going to Adepticon that write for us. And it's either stuff doesn't work out where we just miss each other, or timing never works. And so last year we didn't go to Adepticon because of just a various amount of circumstances. But this year we're going, and Vince and I are trying to make it a big presence. So I sent an email out to like all the authors on the sci-fi and fantasy side. And I said, all right, we're going to Adepticon this year. Who's going? And when can we have you there for author signings? And pretty much no one that we write with is going to Adepticon this year. I think Craig is one of the few that's like, yeah, no, I'll be there. And I'm trying to twist John's arm a little bit to try to get him there, but he's not sure. I don't think he's going to come. But
U.S. geography is pretty limited, but Ben, I think it's quite a long drive for you, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, it's about 19 hours driving across the freeways going about 80 miles an hour kind of thing. So yeah, it's a pretty fair thing. It'd be easier to fly.
I think I could get there quicker than you driving.
Right.
We drive about 12 or 13 hours, something like that. So we try to leave in like the afternoon and get there in the wee morning. But yeah, so it's one of those things where it was like perfect idea. I'm like, well, this is going to be great. We're going to have everybody there. And I'm just like, well, instead, I think I'm going to have to send some books out to people to have them sign, and we can have signed books at the booth. So eventually, someday, I plan to get a couple authors together just to try to get something going where we can advertise more and do book signings and have you guys meet each other and, you know, go out to dinner and have an actual physical conversation. It's one of those things that's easier said than done.
Yeah, it'll never catch on. Mate, we'll get there one day. We'll get there one day.
We'll fly you out for a VIP appearance.
There you go. Although, I don't know, Chicago. I mean, Mark, have you ever... I imagine you've been to the States at some point, being in the Navy and such like that. Have you?
Yeah, I've... the Eastern Seaboard, I know a little bit. So Florida, I've done a fair bit, a couple of times.
I apologize.
One thing.
So Jack's Beach... I've got an amazing tie-dye t-shirt from Jack's Beach. I've loved the States every time I've been across. I've been in, I guess, the locations I've been have been set up for tourism, so that it kind of naturally falls onto them to be welcoming of outsiders. So, I've always had a really friendly reception every time I've been across.
I was just going to say, I don't know if Chicago in winter is going to be the same reception as what you get in Florida, but, I mean, it could be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping to meet Don Johnson in Florida and, you know, sort of see the linen suits with the sleeves rolled up, but all of my 80s dreams, they didn't come into fruition, but I'll get over it.
One of these days. Just got to wait for the trend to come back in. All right, so, Mark... Going back to talking about working with IPs and all of that kind of stuff, we've talked about this, and I know you guys have talked about this in previous episodes, and I know that we talked about it in the last one that I was on with the interview that we did before. But just to touch on it again, one of the potential pitfalls that you have to play with when you're playing with other people's toys, their other IPs, is you have to write an accurate depiction of a setting and its characters, but you have to temper your own expectations and impressions of them in a way that's acceptable to the people that you're writing for, right? So you face this from the community that plays the games that are associated with the IP, but you also have to play that balancing game between the story that you want to write and the narrative that the game maker wants you to tell. And so how do you navigate this sometimes precarious path between catering to expectations and avoiding writing what I call smutty fanfiction? Not that there's anything wrong with that.
If I could sum it up in one word, badly, I suppose. where would we start with this one? I think the fan expectations are really a really good thread to pick out first off. Because, depending on the franchise, my Facebook feed, I don't play 40K a great deal these days, but because of the wargaming interests, it crops up loads on social media for me. And I'm utterly, utterly, utterly blown away by how many online, violent, insulting arguments there are over the minutiae of lore that doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me. It clearly matters to some people. So it shows just how much passion and involvement there is in the industry. And that, to me, with every novel, but particularly the first novel I write in a franchise, that's first and foremost. That's really at the front of thinking. I really, really, really don't want to upset the entire community and let everyone down. And I think with Kings of War, I think we're lucky because it's a pretty chilled out vibe. I've only ever had one Kings of War fan kind of track me down on social media at home and start sending insulting messages. So that's only happened once, whereas in other franchises that's happened more. Exactly. But it's the old cliche goes. It's a really, really loud but tiny minority. So I know, like, when Simon Pegg relatively recently called out the Star Wars fan base for being toxic, I thought that was really unfair because it's not. And a tiny, tiny element of it is. But to say, if you're a Star Wars fan, you are insult here, that's not. So I would never, ever have a go at the fan base of any game, any IP. It's not fair. It's just going to be the fringe elements, and that's because... Well, that's a cross-section of society, isn't it? That you're always going to get that. But just like every company you work for has got a feel and a vibe and better areas in some aspects than others, I think it's the same with the fan bases that you're trying to cater for. And the Kings of War fan base, which is, I guess, largely what we're talking about here today, I think one of the real positives on that is there isn't really that aggressive element, not compared to a lot of others. There aren't online arguments over these things. Not that I've seen, anyway. So
unless you're talking about how to pronounce Basileian.
Basileian. True.
The way that our good buddy Mr. Green does it, and the way I think he was instructed to say it, was Basalia, which I had to train myself to think that way too. So it's bizarre because it does not work phonetically in my brain.
It's tomato tomato. I mean, yeah. I've constantly gone back and forth. I'm the head editor for this company on the sci-fi and fantasy side, but I constantly call it Winged Hussar and Winged Hussar. It's just whatever feels comfortable at the moment. I mean, everybody knows what you're talking about. Mm. So I think it's one thing to say, yes, this is canonly how you say something, but it's another thing to just bicker over it. I mean, even conversations on other shows, I think there was one, I forget what episode, it was on Countercharge, I think, and we were talking about something, and me and somebody else kept pronouncing the same word differently. I didn't bat an eye over it, because it's just, that's how I pronounce it, so you pronounce it, we both know we're talking about the same thing, so...
Exactly. There's stuff to get wrapped around the axle about, I get that. That sort of thing, it doesn't really register on my radar for upsetting me.
Right.
Yeah, going back to what you're saying, so to answer that element of it, I think that side of it in terms of what the community expectation is, that's hugely important to me. It's also this, you can get mission creep, I think, particularly with creative IPs where there's something like, I think role-play games are a really good example of this. It's like, well, so you play a tabletop war game, it's over within 3 hours, or if you play as badly as me, 20 minutes. You don't have to have any lore to that. As soon as you chuck RPGs into it, you do. And things get very lore heavy. And all of a sudden, a game isn't 3 hours. It could be 3 years. And you get really attached to your characters. But you start to drift away from what potentially you start to drift away from what the creators think and know is canon, and you make your own canon, and you don't realize you've strayed from the path. And then all of a sudden a novel will come out, and that novel has been checked by the Lore Master on their throne, because anyone who has the title Lore Master, I hope, has a throne and a fire and a minion bringing them wine and stuff.
Hairless cat required too.
Yeah, definitely. And so when our novels come out, they are lore checked. So I'm still kind of surprised was that there's always this trickle of, well, that's wrong. And it's like, I have made mistakes in lore. Smoke grenades, we can go into that a million times. But by and large, stand fast a few outliers, which are genuine mistakes which slip through the cracks. By and large, 99% of what we're putting out is lore checked, ratified, has checks and balances in place, and is canon. Yet we still upset people.
To be fair, it goes through multiple lore checks too, because you guys send the outlines to the game makers to get approved, and then I go through, and anything that I question, if it's been approved or not, I flag for review. So it's not just like we throw to the wind and see what happens. It goes through multiple sets of eyes. And of course, things will get missed in some cases because, you know, there are things that, you know, I think the things that get missed and people claim are quote unquote wrong are the things that we see as common sense and should be canon, but for whatever reason aren't. And I think there's a level of people need to look at what they're claiming is right or wrong and see, you know, how grand in the scale is this? Or does this seem like something that should be common sense? I think that's the biggest issue, because 90%, I mean, okay, let's go back to what we talked about in our IP. When we first started doing Kings of War with the Edge of the Abyss anthology, we had naiads as male and female. And this is something, Ben, you and I both thought was true when we did Drowned Secrets too, because there was nothing that said they were just female. Now, yes, in the actual real world mythology, I think they're just female. But the models were ambiguous, and there was nothing that ever said specifically they were female. So we just assumed they were male. And that passed in Edge of the Abyss, even with being lore check from the Game Master. So there are things that just, you know, happen because of common sense that people need to just take a step back and say, I can see where they're coming from, but if this is now changed moving forward, you can overlook it. And where nobody is perfect. Let's go on that note.
I would add to that also the fact of, you know, the saying, never meet your heroes. Well, that's true for fictional characters too. Sometimes when we create realistic depictions of what someone would feel and act and how they would act going through some of these, well, let's be honest, they're insanely stressful situations. Nobody's going to react to that the same way that, you know, you imagine your hero doing that. And people are going to have different perspectives of that. And sometimes I think that, Mark, you pointed out perfectly that people get really attached to these characters. Like in the case of the war games, there's named characters for different factions and whatnot, and they play with these characters and they've done these amazing things on the tabletop for them. And so they start building this backlog of their own headcanon as to how these characters would react. And when a story comes out and it's different from that, or heaven forbid, the character is flawed in some way, not that I'm saying that people don't accept this, but there are that reaction, that initial reaction of, that's not my Superman, or that's not my Batman, or whatever the case may be, that's not how my character would react. They feel like that's almost a personal attack on them.
Yeah, I think wargaming is potentially more hazardous for that scenario coming to fruition than nearly any other creative part of the industry. Because if you think of other things, you go, okay, I've read about a comic book, I've seen a movie, a Saturday morning cartoon as a kid, and then you get the action figures and then you play with them. But this is the other way around. You've got the kind of white metal equivalent of an action figure. You play with it, you achieve amazing things. And then years down the line, the story comes out and you get told, no, you're wrong. This is how they are. So, I can see why people might be a bit put on the back foot when our novels come out with named characters, and people may go, that is not what I expected at all.
Or even in the case with you, where you've got Basilia, however you want to say it, you've got that's supposed to be like up to that point, everybody had seen them as these ultimate good guys and all that kind of stuff. But you showed, and I mean, honestly, you have an army with dictators as one of their leaders in the faction. And you bring up some corruption aspects in both Steps to Deliverance and in Faith Aligned about how there's like some incongruity between the religious side of it and the political side of it, and even though they should be intertwined, there's still that friction between the two of them, and you bring that up, and I think that caused a little bit of friction, I think, with some players, because it didn't fit with that idea of, no, these guys are the good guys, they should be, you know, they shouldn't have these kind of problems, they should be united against, you know, the Abyss or whatever the case may be.
That's a really good segue into going back to answering your earlier question, actually. That's a fantastic place to dig in, because there's two things come out of that. One is that good and evil and the expectation. The other is, that was really early in Steps to Deliverance, and I was really, really finding my feet. Still kind of, when you got that blank canvas of, yes, there is books out there with stuff, but not a lot. We've got The City of the Golden Horn, which is where we kind of find this corruption, which, well, Bae Aelia, I'm going to go with for this sentence, is which means that's the capital city, which means that's, you know, from a British point of view, you look at, in centuries gone by, when the British Empire was the largest on the planet, it's the equivalent of London. So it is a huge, huge, huge hub of all sorts of things. And the description of it is in one law book, and it's a couple of paragraphs. You're like, that's all I got to go on. So that's quite tricky, because you want to expand on it, but you don't want to expand too much, because you're not the law master, and it feels a little bit disingenuous to say, this hugely important city, this which is critical to the entire part of the world, I'm going to be the one as an outsider who hasn't played this game much to crowbar my way in here and tell everyone this is how it is. You can't do that, I don't think. So I was a bit vague in places, because I was still finding my feet with the branch. But the good versus evil side of it, it's interesting that you say that you'd heard of people who said that perhaps I hadn't portrayed them good enough. I was worried about exactly the opposite, because in my mind, it was Kings of War Edition 2 at the time, I think, and you've got alignments, and alignment good, page one, Bae Aelia, and so bang, it's a good faction, that's that. And then I remembered, I think it was seeing a interview with Ronnie Renton, and he passed like several, and it's his baby, he's the CEO, he passed several references to the good guys, or are they, and kept making all these sinister remarks about, are they bad guys? They've got dictators. That's not normally a good word. And you start to think, and I thought, well, I'm going to make it a bit of a grey area. I'm going to have people who are clearly altruistic, in old money, lawful good. But I'm going to have people who aren't as well. And that was the attempt. And I thought I hadn't gone far enough, rather than too far with it.
Yeah, it's that. I think you nailed it pretty well. I mean, pretty much the majority of the player base, and being a member of that community and a avid player of Kings of War, I would say that for the most part, Steps to Deliverance is pretty universally accepted as a great starting point for the novels, and it's what a lot of people will recommend as a good jumping off point. And I think a lot of people accept it as, yeah, this is good. So I think you did a great job in that regards. I think I got it covered in the next one about how we showed the darker side of Bae Aelia, and we saw the reaction that got from some people too. So it goes both ways. So I think though that Steps to Deliverance and its accompanying sequels, I think they're a great addition to the lore. I think it did a great job of setting up the novel universe and getting everything, giving us a launching point to go off of it. So you had a big weight on your shoulders with that, because you weren't originally scheduled to be the first one.
All All right, so before we go on to talking about the start of the Kings of War novels and how that came to be, I just want to slide into a quick commercial break. So I just want to thank today's sponsor, On Military Matters, your source for new, used, and out-of-print books on military history, wargaming, and modeling. Check them out at onmilitarymatters.com and make sure to sign up for the weekly e-flyer.
All right, so talking about how you were the first character and all that kind of stuff, you kind of already answered the question that I was going to ask about. Let's see if you have anything more to add on this before we move on to the next question that we have. But for you, what separates writing for an IP from just simple fan fiction? Because I know that I myself, when I was playing Warhammer, had several fan fiction novels that I had written just because it was fun and it helped my local gaming group. But what would you say is the determining factor in drawing that distinction between fan fiction and officiality within the universe?
I think to give, as I keep doing all of these questions, here's the top line down answer, then go into more detail. As detached as it sounds, it is, does it have the canon law master on his throne seal of approval? I don't think it's anything to do with quality as such. So if whoever owns the IP puts their logo on it, that's when it ceases to become fan fiction and becomes canon. That's that. So anything else, no matter what the quality, is fan fiction. Which, and I, similar to what you said before, I don't think it's fair to use fanfiction as a derogatory term, but you see it quite a lot online. Yeah. As if you call something fanfiction, you are therefore implying it's fifth grade. And it might not be. And I think there's some really, really, really good fanfiction out there that is better, is produced to a higher quality than some of the official stuff in some franchise. It's also how we've found some of our new authors. You know, I'm pre-editor, I suppose, on a short story anthology for Kings of War Armada at the moment, and we've got a number of new first-time authors, and we have found them via fan fiction. It's how we've got Tommaso, I hope it's pronounced that, who does a whole lot of our interior artwork for us. He was a semi-professional, did artwork, and saw him on a forum and just said, this guy's amazing, he's really good. But it's not official until he then gets the stamp on it. That's part of Kings of War and Infinity and so on. So, yeah, that's the longer answer is, I think it's as simple as, has it got a stamp on it? But that does not equate to quality at all.
Yeah, and I think you nailed that perfectly. I think... I've read fan fiction that is certainly more well thought out and developed than certain official novels. And I think that you're going to have that, especially the bigger the IP gets. So continuing on with that, so let's delve more into your writing style then. Specifically, what is it that draws you to a story? Like you've mentioned before that your characters are the foremost in your stories. So in that regard, what comes first? Like we've talked about how you characters have to be real, they have to be something that you can believe in and all that kind of stuff. So do you start off by, because the way you answer your questions is, as you just said, is you start from the top and work down, top view and then zoom in. So do you craft a scenario and then come up with a protagonist that would be the most interested in dealing with that situation? Or do the characters come first and then you like put them in a small room and let them interact and see what drama unfolds from that little mental projection that you can build?
Exactly as you described it on the second one. That's exactly it for me. I try and dive into the character side of it. From the feedback I've had, it tends to be the characters I'm coming out with. And I try to go for the ensemble cast. I never try and go for one lead character, because if the reader doesn't like that lead character, you kind of hope that of an ensemble cast, there'll be one they can relate to. I come out with those characters first, and then, dare I say, without being, you know, falling on my sword too much, come out with a paper-thin plot to take them from to the end of the story, because it's all about those characters and how they grow, how they change, and... Exactly, you said, heaven forbid, how they address their flaws. Yeah, that's so. But I am. I'm also aware. I hope I'm self-aware enough to know that my plots and my storylines, they are not complicated, and that's not one of my stronger areas. There's so many better authors out there at our level that we're talking about. You know, kind of Wing to Tsar level, who do storylines so much more involved and complex and intricate and with twists and turns. I don't. I just try and do that with a character.
Well, I think you made a really good point there in the fact that the thing that makes a character interesting is how they interact with their flaws. How do they overcome them? I think that's you use that as the plot device to move them forward, and I think that's fascinating because nothing's more boring than a Mary Sue, right? Than somebody that's got all the answers all the time. They never make mistakes or anything along those lines. So I think you hit that perfectly.
Oh, that's certainly the aspiration. And yeah, my favorite novel if I could pick one novel, my favorite novel is Piece of Cake by Derek Robinson, which I've talked about in, which is a story about a British fighter squadron in the first year of World War II. And there is no storyline. The storyline is World War II, the first year, September 39 to September 40. That's it. But the whole story is about this cast of characters who come and go, who die and flee. And it is all about people. I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's so well done. Yet the storyline, there isn't really one.
Well, speaking of characters, which of your characters do you like the most? Which was the most fun to write? And which romantic couple did you like the most? Kind of a three-parter here, but I'm going to hit you all of them at once.
Oh, gosh. Romance. Men can't write about romance. You can't do that. So I've been told so many times. Which is a weird thing to say. I don't do it well, but I do like to write about that stuff because I just think it's a... If you you meet someone new and you talk to them, and it's one of the first things that will come up is their family life. Are they married? Do they have kids? That's really important to so many people. So to remove that from a character, I think is a little bit odd. It has its place. If you were to look at stuff like 40K, Space Marines almost universally have none of that, and it would be weird if they did. It wouldn't fit the setting. So I get that. There's a time and a place to completely surgically cut it out and have none of it. In terms of the favourite character, I think sticking within Kings of War, it's between Orion and James, I think. So if we stick with Orion first, Orion was never supposed to be the lead character of that novel. And the reason being is I grew up with 80s and 90s action movies and TV shows and stuff like that. And so the entertainment culture I grew up with was basically about heroic, adventurous, gung-ho, chisel-jawed, incredibly good-looking people blowing stuff up and doing feats of which are physically difficult. It was very physical heroes. You see that change in if you look at a 1980s cop movie like Lethal Weapon, or Die Hard, that's a 1980s cop. 1990s, you look at Speed, and you've got a character who's someone who is intelligent, plays by the rules, and is the boss's favourite, and you see a cultural shift. I grew up before that, so it was about here's your good looking hero, as in Lethal Weapon, who's crazy, unhinged, dangerous, violent, and gets the good looking girl, and that was the package. So I kind of like that cliched, old-fashioned story. I like the way it's done. But I'm also aware that the world's changed, so I didn't want... So that was always going to be my favourite character, Orion, but I didn't want him to be the lead. But I just found the more and more I wrote, the more and more I thought, if I write more and more about Tancred, who is the lead character, I think I'm going to be forcing myself to write stuff I'm not interested in. If the author's not interested in it, what chance has the reader got? So I just found as I went into it, one character took a step back and one character became far more prominent. And by the end of it, it's like, well, I need to write the blurb now. And actually, Orion's the lead character, if I'm honest with myself. So So yeah, I think he was favorite character, but I wanted to Boba Fett him and Boba Fett, sorry, and have him as kind of in, you know, the original trilogy. Huge character, huge cult following, very limited screen time, and sometimes less is more. And if you don't overexpose a character, they can be really popular. And that's what I wanted to do with Orion. It just didn't work. So it just ended up being the hero of it.
Well, that's interesting from an editor point of view, because I actually didn't... I like Tancred a lot, but I never... Maybe we talked about it in the early stages, and I just forget, but I never thought he was supposed to be the protagonist. I always thought it was supposed to be Orion, mostly because he was the intro character. But that's really interesting. I like hearing that. That's one of those things that this podcast is for, to get into little details like that.
Yeah, it's... I think if I had more strings to my bow creatively, I could have made Tancred the lead character. But his journey, I still think, is a good story to tell, I hope, which is, here's someone who is ambitious, politically minded, but it's also, it's not really all coming from them. It's enforced from a overly ambitious parent. And they're just kind of wearing a mask of, I'm going to go places, I'm going to be a politician, I'm going to be a senator. My military career is just a stepping stone to that. But that's all been parentally enforced. And actually, underneath it all is a good person who's just forgotten, who's lost their way. And that's the kind of journey of that character. Whereas Orion, on the other side, is someone who is the underdog all their childhood and is second best at best, and then has a traumatic event which makes them become fearless and overcompensate and become a horrific bully. And it's about that journey of turning back from that and becoming a good person again. So that's kind of that's the story of Steps to Deliverance to me, is the characters and who they are and what they become. The battles, that's more just...
Oh gosh, yeah. The battles
are the journey. That's again the stepping stones to take the characters through their progression, rather than for me.
The steps to deliverance.
Oh man, I queued you up for that, which is good because I was fumbling on my words there, and you've got me out of it. So thank you.
I'm sorry, I had to make it.
So I wanted to point out something that I noticed as you're talking about these. The thing that's the most fascinating to me is character study, right? You mentioned that your favorite book is essentially character study of this fighter pilot squadron, right? And in this case, listening to you talk about Tancred and Orion, it's apparent that there's bits and pieces of relatability in both of them, right? Personally, I found Tancred the more interesting of the two, because I feel like he was... I could detect things that I recognize, like the idea of there's this expectation of me, I need to do these things, I need to make something of myself because, well, that's my family legacy and all that kind of stuff. And honestly, you have that with Orion too. Both of them are having their parental figures imposing something on them. With Orion, it's unintentional in the fact that his uncle dies, and that trauma is what then shapes Orion, based off of familial obligations that he feels that are self-imposed. And then you have Tancred, who is also being exposed to this familial expectations that is explicitly stated by his parents of, hey, you're going to do this, you have to do that in order to uphold the family name and all that kind of stuff. And so you have this play between these two characters that are both being controlled by these external pressures that they have internalized in different ways. One is through trauma, and the other one is through a different kind of that burden of expectation. And so you've got these two fascinating characters in that regard, and the way that they play off of each other is quite interesting. And then you have his foil, Orion's foil in Estelle, in many ways, where she's also had her form of trauma and has rejected those familial things. And so the playoff of those is where the character growth for Orion really starts to go, whereas Tancred has the reaction from his interactions with Orion and seeing how that plays out on the battlefield. So you do a really good job of making these character connections and jumping off of each other. I want to know is... And it feels very organic, so I think I know the answer to this question, but did that grow out of just mental exercises of seeing how they would act and just putting yourself in each of these characters' shoes, because they have to come from your personal background or well, or things that you've seen or experienced. But did this grow organically out of you putting yourself in their position, or was that in some ways kind of plotted out as part of your character sketches before you even got started?
I'm glad it worked, because everything that you've just said there was not even a second where I winced and thought, no, that's not what I was trying to say. Everything you've said there was exactly what I was trying to say about those three characters, so that's fantastic. Yeah, I think when we write the characters, you can do a mustache-twirling, cliched villain who you will not relate to. But by and large, I think if for any protagonist, there's got to be a piece of the author in there somewhere. If you're going to write them convincingly, it doesn't have to be anything really overt, but there has to be something, an element. So certainly all of these characters I've written and any of their flaws and struggles, it'll be something personal to make that come out. And I think with how do you actually get there from A to B, for me, stepping stones to deliverance again, it's about these stepping stones. And when I'm planning out a novel, I'll think about character A, B, and C will start in this mindset. They will have this flaw. By the end, here's where I want them to get to, which is not a perfect person, but a better person who's still got challenges to overcome. So what events am I going to put to make that happen, to make them have that realization? And most of those events aren't huge battlefield victories or anything. They are encounters. They are a conversation. They are an argument. They are something where you bounce off each other to have a realization that maybe that other person's right and I need to change. And so that's my roadmap, I guess, for each story. So definitely for Steps to Deliverance, when it's been a good few years since I wrote that. But when I stop back and look at that, there was a lot more thought that went into the characters on that than some of the other ones where I had different objectives and different priorities. So, but yeah, Orion and Estelle were always supposed to be at the lower end of the primary protagonists. Tancred was supposed to be a bigger character. Who else did we have in that cast?
The Constance. Captain of... Yeah, Constance, that's what her name is.
Constance was an interesting character as well, because I don't think when you're doing a story that you should have quotas to go for. But I spoke to a friend in the early days of that who very much did. And said, you've got four primary characters, three of them are men, one's a woman. I don't think that's fair. So that mercenary, make that a woman. And I did, and that became Constance. And I think from that point of view, the best thing about writing Constance was I didn't write, here's a woman, I just said, here's a mercenary. And that character's sex and gender it didn't matter. It was just a person. So I wrote Constance as a person and tried to make that individual as well-rounded as I could, irrespective of any characteristics. It didn't matter. And from what some people have come back, some people have said that went well. For me, I think it could have gone better. I think that's a, dare I say, relatively bland character who could have been fleshed out more. Yeah, that was how that character came into being anyway.
Well, if I can throw my two cents in real quick. I think Constance did her job of being a support character without overshadowing the other characters, in the point where I remembered her name right off the bat and I could remember a good amount of her story without overshadowing the rest of the cast. I think you did a good job with that, you know, especially because she didn't go on to any of the other books. I think if you wanted to reuse her as a reoccurring character, then yeah, we could have fleshed her out a little bit more. But I think for what her job was in Steps to Deliverance, I think it was well executed. And it's interesting that you said that Orion and Estelle were at the lower half of the protagonist ladder when the sequels were about their two journeys. So I found that, I thought that was really interesting, because in the next two books that follow, those roles pretty much reverse, and Tancred becomes the quick cameo character in Faith Aligned, which we can get to in the next episode, and Estelle and Orion become the two protagonists of their individual books. So that's interesting how that flipped.
Yeah, I think having done Steps to Deliverance and finished it, and it's like, okay, I had a plan, and that plan hasn't gone the way I expected it to. I know Ben and I have spoken about this in previous interviews and podcasts and things, that very, very, very roughly there are two ways of writing a novel. One is you plan it to the finest detail and you write it in a wanna.
The other is you give a really superficial overview, and then you're going to have to accept you're going to do a lot of rewriting. I fall into that the second category. I have a rough plan, and then I see where the story takes me. And that's what happened with Steps to Deliverance. It didn't take me in, where I thought it would. It just didn't work. When you actually get to sitting down and writing a 250-page novel, unless you've really, really, really planned it, it might not go exactly as you expect it to. And that's what happened with Orion, probably going to be my favourite character. He's an 80s action hero, after all, but he's a background character. And then he ends up being the lead character. Estelle, pretty similar. Was supposed to be a kind of femme fatale who popped in and out of the story a little bit and then disappeared. But it's like, no, I actually quite liked that character. And then Tancred and Constance didn't end up being at the fore as much as I initially planned. It was supposed to be their story, really, those two.
Tancred kind of appears as a secondary character in, well, a minor cameo in Faith Aligned. Are we going to see any more of him? And do you have any plans to reuse Constance at all?
Never say never, because any of these things can change. Constance, no. Tancred, yes.
Well, I think if we've learned anything with our first interview, I think it's a good point that we cut it here, because we have a lot more to touch on, and I think we're going to need the right amount of time to work on it. So we've talked a lot about Mark as an author, and we've kind of given some more finer details about Steps to Deliverance that I don't think we've really hit on in any of the other interviews we've been on. But the next episode, we're going to pick Mark's brain a little bit more with some more characters. You know, we're going to touch on Hero Falling, Faith Aligned, and Pious, like I said. So we're going to go into more detail about those specific characters and, you know, how he went about crafting those stories. Thanks for listening. I'm Brandon Rossbaum.
I'm Mark Barber.
I'm Ben Stoddard.
And we'll see you guys in the next episode.